I'm John Krall. On today's No Limits, we're going to talk about water. The crisis in Flint, Michigan has focused national and international attention on the importance of having and maintaining safe, healthy water sources. Some of the same problems have hit Greentown, Indiana, where lead has been found in the water. We're going to discuss the quality of our water and what we can do to make sure it is safe. My guests are Tracy Cadell, superintendent of Eastern Howard School Corporation, Andrew Berger of the Indiana Manufacturers Association, and Indra Frank of the Hoosier Environmental Council. Please call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, or find us on social media to join the conversation. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about water quality and legislation regarding water quality. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Tracy Cadell, who is the superintendent of Eastern Howard Schools, and joining me in the studio, Tracy Cadell is joining us by phone, is Indra Frank, who is the Environmental Health Director for the Hoosier Environmental Council, and Andrew Berger, who is Vice President of Governmental Affairs and Tax Policy for the Indiana Manufacturers Association. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Hi.
It's good to have you all here. You know, we probably ought to start, obviously, the whole story of Flint, Michigan's troubles has preoccupied. And there's a tendency to think that that might be the only place it's happening, when in fact we found it maybe not quite to the same degree, that it is possible to have challenges such as the ones that are hitting Flint here in Indiana, including Superintendent Cadell, Tracy, a situation in your backyard. Am I right?
Yes, you are right, although I do want to make it clear we're not like Flint, Michigan. Our elevated lead level was 22 parts per billion, and in Flint it was as high as 13,000, at least in one instance.
That's almost more lead than water. But so could you walk me through exactly how you came to find out about this?
Sure. It had been brought to our attention from a patron in November that the Greentown Municipal Utility Company had been testing some older homes in Greentown, and they had advised some of their customers that they had an elevated lead level. And that obviously piqued our attention, and so we made the decision to take the initiative and go ahead and test our water. And unfortunately, we had a special needs classroom that had an elevated lead level.
And it was what was the level that you found in that special needs classroom?
It was 22 parts per billion, and the EPA recommended level, I believe, is 15 parts per billion.
So about half again as large as it should be, right? I mean, if my math is right here, it's
sure.
About 50% over the recommended level.
And that's correct.
What are you doing about it?
Well, at the time, we immediately shut down the sink in that classroom. And then after having consultation with the Howard County Health Department and the Indiana State Department of Health, a couple of days later, we decided to shut down everything and do more testing. And so we're still in that process of serving bottled water and cooking with water that's provided from an outside source. And so that's where we're at right now.
So when you say you shut down everything, does that mean you shut down athletes aren't taking showers, things like that? Or?
Well, that's a good question. On February 3rd, we did initially do that. We shut down so that athletes couldn't shower and but on February 5th, we lifted that restriction to make sure that students could wash their hands, we could shower, those sorts of things. But we're still serving bottled water for drinking and for cooking.
What has that done to your budget?
Well, it's costly. It's about 400. We're a small school corporation, 1,500 students, so it's still costly. It's about $400 a day to provide 2,500 bottles of water to our school corporation. I can tell you kids are more hydrated, though, than they've ever been. They love getting bottled water.
Okay, so basically it's costing you, is that $400 per school day, or is it $400 for the seven-day week?
No, per school day.
So it's about a $2,000, an extra $8,000 to $10,000 every month then, right?
Absolutely. But we've had some donations from various folks in the community, and that's been very helpful.
And what has the reaction been among the members of the community there?
Well, certainly they're concerned, but they've been very supportive of the school district. We have tried to be very transparent. We've put information on our website. We've put information through Twitter and other social media. We've tried to keep our parents well informed. So for the most part, they've been very happy with the school's response.
Okay. Andrew, I'm going to ask you to jump in here. Tell us a little bit about why finding elevated levels of lead in your water is not a good thing.
Right. Lead is toxic to the nervous system. And it's toxic even in minute quantities, and it's particularly toxic for young children, either the child that's developing during the mother's pregnancy or up through age 5 when the brain is growing and developing so rapidly. Lead poisoning, children who've been exposed to lead wind up with an IQ that's lower than it should have been and at increased risk for behavior problems.
And what, when you say it is toxic, what are some of the things that it does then? Obviously, how does it go about lowering the IQ? What are the physical effects? What does it do to a person's body and, I presume, brain and nervous system?
Well, it's damaging to neurons in the nervous system for a variety of biochemical reasons that I probably better not to go into. But yeah, it's damaging to the neurons and the connections between neurons in the nervous system.
And so I'm guessing that there are probably folks in Howard County and Greentown right now who are listening and are concerned. Is there if, for example, before they discovered this, if a child had a glass of water in that classroom or in those homes, is that likely to have this effect, or does there have to be prolonged exposure for the damage really to take effect?
John, it's an excellent question. I teach environmental toxicology at the IU Fairbanks School of Public Health, and mm-hmm. in toxicology, this is one of the things we really focus on. What's the dose? And here, of course, the dose is both the concentration of lead that's in the water and the duration of time that someone is consuming that water. The longer, of course, that someone's consuming it, the worse, and the higher the concentration, the worse that would be. I think it's important to keep in mind that we try to avoid any exposure to lead. In fact, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control has stated that there is no safe level of lead exposure. Now, that being said, at the kinds of low exposures we're talking about in Greentown, it's probably, if it has impacted a certain number of neurons, it probably wouldn't be enough to make a detectable difference. And it sounds like the school district has really gotten right on top of the issue.
Has moved proactively. And then I'm going to take this back, and I'll throw it open to anyone here who wants to answer the question: How does lead get into water? How do we see these elevated levels develop here? Indra, do you want to take that one? I see you.
Sure.
I can't see Tracy because obviously Tracy is on the phone, but I saw Andrew looking in your direction and you nodding. So I'll go with you.
Yeah, I've actually spent several years working on lead poisoning prevention. Most of that was having to do with lead in paint. As soon as the news from Flint hit, though, I started reading about lead in drinking water and reading the regulations related to that. The water itself wouldn't have lead in it, except that it's passing through either lead pipes or pipes that have been soldered together with lead solder, and the water can pick up the lead as it goes through those.
So is this a much larger problem? I mean, is this something that, you know, obviously Flint has become the poster child now, but could we have similar situations around the country? Because I know, you know, I mean, people of my generation joke that we probably almost every house we grew up in had lead-based paint and all of that sort of stuff. Is it likely that we could be facing, if not on the scale of Flint, many Flints across the country?
Well, yeah, I think we could. There have been a number of cities that have had lead in drinking water problems. Washington, D.C. in 2001, Durham, North Carolina in 2006, Columbia, South Carolina 2005. Along with Flint last year, Sebring, Ohio also detected lead in their drinking water. So we do have problems with lead in our plumbing, and that's why we have the federal regulations regarding testing for lead in water and protocols and treatments for water to try to reduce the amount of lead that the water picks up.
Tracy, long-term, what is the solution for your school system? I mean, presumably the goal is not to keep bringing bottled water in there, but to figure out a way to get the lead.
We're hoping to transition back to the Greentown Municipal Water Company. The first step was actually Greentown Municipal Water is adding phosphates to the water as of last Friday, I believe. And so that will help our situation. Our buildings are older. They were built in the mid-1960s. We've had a number of renovations. And so we do know that some of our piping is pre-1986, which I believe was the date when it was changed that you could not have lead solder joints any longer. So we've worked with a company here, a mechanical company, and we're identifying every pipe in our school system and determining the age of that pipe. And then we're going to work with IDEM and the Howard County Health Department on the protocols that we need to take to move forward. But the first step is it has happened, and that was Greentown Municipal Waters has added phosphates, which will help that situation.
And I almost hesitate to ask, but do you have an anticipated cost for it sounds like you're going to have to do probably rip out a fair amount of the plumbing in your building?
Well, we don't at this point. I mean, it's going to be thousands of dollars, but hopefully through IDEM and the Howard County Health Department, through the protocols and potentially having options, for example, could we put filtration systems on our water fountains, or would we actually have to rip out pipes, or will the phosphate take care of the situation so that we do not have the lead issue? So we are at this point still consulting with those various agencies, but I anticipate it'll still be a little longer before we transition back to Greentown Municipal Water.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about water quality and the things we have to do to make sure that we have the proper water quality. If you would like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. So we've identified here that it is in some ways a problem of the pipes and all of that, and that presumably it's buildings that are older, right? And are you guaranteed if there is lead in the pipes that they're going to have elevated lead levels in the water? No, Andrew, you're shaking your head.
Well, we have an issue with older buildings, but also older infrastructure.
Yeah.
And you asked the superintendent the cost to his school. I mean, businesses, residential, are having to bear these costs too. I know in Greentown in the summer they raised their rates by, I think, over 50%. So the utility clearly recognizes some need to upgrade their systems. But if they're doing the testing and doing the mitigation, you know, they'll have to keep at it. But that may be enough to solve the problem, at least in this circumstance.
So, and the phosphate is one sort of interim step. I mean, is this a problem? And I'll tell you what, we will pose that question because it does get into to the legislation after we come back from the break. We are talking about water quality across the country, but specifically in Greentown, Indiana, and in Flint, Michigan, here on No Limits. My guests are Tracy Goodell, who is superintendent of Eastern Howard Schools, and Indra Frank, who is environmental health director for the Hoosier Environmental Council, and Andrew Berger, who is vice president of governmental affairs and tax policy for the Indiana Manufacturers Association. I'm John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about water quality. Specifically, we're talking about an outbreak of lead contamination or elevated lead levels in the water in Greentown, Indiana. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Tracy Cadell, who is the superintendent of Eastern Howard Schools, Indra Frank, who is environmental health director for the Hoosier Environmental Council, and Andrew Berger, who is vice president of governmental affairs and tax policy for the Indiana Manufacturers Association. And we're going to lose Tracy here in a bit. We've got a limited amount of time, so I'm going to jump the conversation ahead. There is legislation right now before the Indiana General Assembly that deals with this issue. Could one of you speak to what the legislation is, and then we'll get to some of the ramifications? Andrew, do you want me to start with you?
I can start. Andrew. That's fine.
Okay.
Yes, there is legislation, but I don't know if we're talking about the same bill. If you're mentioning the No More Stringent Than bill, that mm-hmm. does not have anything to do with Flint or Greentown mm-hmm. or any other lead contamination issue. Now, there are bills that would provide mm-hmm. mechanisms to fund water infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really, I think, the issue that they're seeing in Michigan and in Indiana. We have this aging infrastructure that does cause problems. We need to find out a way to, you know, be sure that we're mitigating when we can and upgrading when we should. But the bill that the Hoosier Environmental Council has been so adamantly against and raising, I think, unfortunately, Flint, which is a very serious situation, as a reason behind this bill or a reason to stop it, that's not the case, because it's House Bill 1082, in which the Manufacturers Association and a number of others are very strongly in favor of, would not have anything to do with lead contamination in Indiana's water supply.
What specifically does the bill do?
The bill requires, if Indiana is writing rules about federal environmental regulations, that we go no more stringent, no stricter than what the feds require. If we wanted to go more stricter, we still can, but it would take an act of the legislature to specifically grant that authority to IDEM to do that. So it says very simply, if we're going to be more strict than the feds, more strict than the EPA, that policy needs to come from the State House and not from regulators. So that's what the bill does.
Okay, and Tracy, I know you have to scoot. Normally I would throw this back to Indra right away, but because I know you, and I know, Tracy, that you offered testimony on 1082, what was your objection to the bill?
Well, I just want to make sure that the bill does not allow or force less testing than what we currently have, because I believe we need more. I mean, Eastern Howard took the initiative to test our water. We were not mandated to test, as I understand the law. The utility company was mandated to test older homes, and we took the initiative to do that. And I just want to make sure that that would never be that would not be taken away from us. And so I have concerns anytime you delegate to the federal government. In my mind, it takes away some of the local control aspect, and I want to make sure that we can always, for the safety of our kids, do what's necessary.
Okay. Indra, and I should ask Tracy, how much longer can you stay with us?
Maybe about 3 more minutes, and that'd be about it.
3 more minutes? Okay. Well, then I'm going to throw this real quickly to Indra and maybe give you a chance to offer a last word. What are the Hoosier Environmental Council's concerns with 1082?
We have quite a number of concerns. It is possible that 1082 could interfere with the state's ability to address the issue of lead in water. Because the bill is very broad, it would prohibit the Environmental Rules Board and the agency from taking action when the federal regulations have gaps in them. And our federal regulations do have gaps. In fact, I've found gaps in the federal regulation having to do with lead in drinking water.
So if I understand this correctly, then in effect, establishing standards in terms of protecting water quality and other things, it sounds like it's not confined exclusively to water, is taken out of the hands of regulators and put in the hands of legislators.
In certain aspects, it is only when we're implementing federal law. And this is the Safe Water Drinking Act, federal standard, so it does apply here. But if the Hoosier Environmental Council is right and there are gaps, the Indiana rules have been in place since 1994. These gaps have been in existence for a number of times. All we're saying is that if you want to go beyond what the feds say, you need to take it to the legislature. And, I mean, if we need more testing, the superintendent can test as much as he or she or anybody else in the state wants. We're talking about what's the government is going to require people to do. And if that is the policy of the state, that we need more of this, then we think it should be passed through the legislature before we're entitled to do that. And if the HEC or anybody else wants to offer legislation to do more lead testing, that's perfectly fine. That's the process that it should occur through, though.
But, Tracy, I mean, at some level, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, and I know you got to go, so I'm throwing this last question at you. As I understand your argument, and I did read your testimony, at least part of the problem here is that it is an interconnected system, that you have the authority to test what was going on in your schools, but not through any of the other pipes that water may have come through. So, you know, there is this idea that, you know, every boat should float on its own may not be entirely feasible. Is that a fair interpretation of your concern?
Well, I think so, because in our particular cases, I understand the law, and there's folks that are a lot more well-versed than I am. Greentown actually had 3 to 5 years to put a phosphate system in place under the federal regulations. And so if we wouldn't have tested, that would have meant 3 to 5 more years, potentially, that our children could have been exposed. And so I would just be very cautious in allowing the federal government to make those final decisions. And I also think, you know, the General Assembly only meets for a very limited time each year. So if you're having to wait on the General Assembly to allow you to do this, I think you could get caught in the summer or some other time where it may not happen.
Well, that's a reasonable concern, but it shouldn't be a problem here. We're making a choice between the rulemaking process and the legislative process, and at minimum, the rulemaking lasts 18 months. The legislature is every 12 months. So if it's speed is the worry, it's actually better to hope for legislation. Now, I'll just mention this. Emergency powers are unaffected by this bill. The governor, if he has to do something, if IDEM has to do something for public, the, to protect the public, they can do that, and they would be able to do that under this bill.
Tracy, I know you've got to go, so I'm going to say thank you for joining us.
Yes,
and appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Thank you, and I'm going to toss it to Indra now.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Bye-bye.
Well, I can address the question of the speed with which environmental policy can be enacted. Mm-hmm. If the legislature does take up a bill, first off, it can take multiple years for an idea to get it to work its way through the legislative process. That's one problem. Another is that while the legislature has legislators that have a wide variety of skills, there are very few who understand the technical details of drinking water systems and anti-corrosion protocols and source water treatment. I think those technical details are better left to the experts at the Department of Environmental Management. And then when it comes to how rapidly something can be implemented, even if the legislature did pass a law and they were able to pass it in 1 year, at that point, that law would have to go to the agency for rulemaking in order to be implemented. So it is not possible for the legislature to be faster.
So ultimately, it would be, instead of a year-and-a-half process, it would be a two-and-a-half-year process because you'd have a legislative
unless
process.
Unless we had an emergency situation.
Yeah.
Unless we had. Well, I'm going to ask the obvious question here. Just in listening to this, it sounds to me like what we're doing is turning the legislators into the regulators.
No, we already have many issues in the Indiana Code where CAFOs is a great example. I'm not a CAFO expert, but
probably ought to define what a CAFO is.
Yeah, it's a confined animal feeding operation. It's large hog processing. We have a lot of that in Indiana. Indiana is regulating that on her own, mm-hmm. and the legislature hasn't gotten into details, but they've established specific parameters with specific authority for IDEM to operate under, and that's again, independent of this bill, because that is, again, what we think the process should be, that we establish the policy at the State House, give specific authority to IDEM to write rules, and not broadly interpreting federal law. When that happens, to go above what the feds require, when we want to be more stringent, you have to get approval from the legislature to do it. That's what the bill does.
Okay. And Indra, earlier, because we were trying to get as much out of Tracy as we could before we had to let him go, you mentioned that the Hoosier Environmental Council had a lot of objections to the bill, and you were only able to list one, maybe two of them. In broader parameters, it sounds to me like your organization's larger concern here is that it is undercutting the regulatory process just in general.
Well, yeah, but also I think one of the big problems with it is that it's unnecessary. This bill is intended to prevent overzealous regulation, but in Indiana statute, we already have 13 different statutes that put in place checks and balances and prevent overzealous regulation. And in fact, in testimony about the bill, it wasn't possible, or no examples were brought up from the last 15 years of overzealous regulation. So it's trying to prevent overzealous regulation, but we already have checks and balances in place, and we don't have a history of overzealous regulation.
We are talking today on No Limits about water quality and environmental concerns. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Marion has done and send us an email. If you do that, please send it to nolimits@wfyi.org. And Marion says, the agricultural establishment who support House Bill 1082 are those intent on continued self-destructing expansion of livestock production in Indiana, despite all evidence that this is harmful, unjust, and cruel. Facts tell us the best thing we can do to save our water is to stop eating animal products. We need to talk about how to humanely dismantle confined animal feeding operations and restore our chemical fertilizer-laden cropland, which lays bare 8 months of the year. The inevitable lawsuits HB 1082 would invoke, like those against CAFOs now, allow the harm to continue. We are facing catastrophic water shortages, waste. We are unprotected by our government. Our rural communities are being devastated. May this lead crisis help us rebuild and change as we demand change. Andrew, I think that obviously calls for some sort of response from you.
I don't know if banning the eating of meat is something that I can personally get behind, but you know, people have the opportunity to petition their legislator, vote in the elections. I mean, it's a political process right now. That's actually what we're trying to affirm with this bill, that we have open debates, that all sides are able to weigh in, that we get technical expertise when necessary. All that would be open to this emailer and anybody else. This bill doesn't stop this woman or this person from expressing their concerns.
Marion. And then we got a question for you, Indra. It says, why do we need protection stronger than the EPA's? Aren't their protections good enough? Also, as trained professionals, aren't IDEM and the Environmental Rules Boards the experts on environmental issues, not legislators? So I guess actually there's one for both of you there. Indra, we'll take the first one first. Why do we need protection stronger than the EPA's, and aren't their protections good enough?
Well, I'll go back to the lead in drinking water issue for this one. In studying the federal lead and copper rule for drinking water, I found that it has gaps in it, and those are gaps that Indiana would be authorized to address if House Bill 1082 doesn't go through. The gap that I was most concerned about is that once a drinking water provider finds lead, there's a series of steps that they have to go through that can take several years to implement. And during that entire time, or at least under the regulation, they have several years to bring that to conclusion. And during that entire time, there's nothing to stop them from continuing to deliver that lead-tainted water to homes and businesses. The federal regulation says nothing about stopping that. I would like to be able to go to the drinking water section at the Indiana's Environmental Management Agency. Those are the professionals who understand Indiana's drinking water sources, the wells, the reservoirs, and the rivers that we depend on. They're the ones who understand our drinking water treatment systems and the pipes and delivery systems. They also know the ins and outs of things like anti-corrosion protocols and source water treatment. I would like to be able to talk with them about ways to shorten that timeline. Which of those remedies can be stepped up and shortened? And I think that conversation would be more productive with them than it would going to our legislature. I agree with Andrew that our legislature needs to set the broad policy objectives and the architecture under which the agencies implement policy for Indiana. But I think this bill would call into question their authority to work within those details and get things done.
Andrew, also as trained professionals, aren't IDEM and the Environmental Rules Board experts on environmental issues, not legislators?
That's true, but it doesn't alleviate the legislature of their duty to set the broad policies. And that's really what this bill says. I've said it once, I'll say it again. The legislature sets the policy, and the feds have guidelines. We just think it should be a policy decision to go beyond those. I mean, one of the things that, since we're talking about Indiana's lead rules that I'll mention real quickly, is that every rule is grandfathered in under this bill. Nothing that Indiana is currently obligated to do under their state or federal requirements would change. So under our testing, which Indra keeps bringing up, I mean, I've said it, these have been in place from 1994. There's been no criticism of the gaps for the last 20 years. I question why we haven't been talking to these regulators if this is such a problem in that time. I think if we do want to close any gaps to prevent these types of situations, we can do that. I'm sure the legislators would be receptive to that. I think probably the IMA and a number of others would too.
We are talking about water quality and water safety here on No Limits. My guests are Indra Frank of the Hoosier Environmental Council and Andrew Berger of the Indiana Manufacturers Association. We're going to be taking calls after we come back from the break, so I'm going to ask our listeners to hang in there with us. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about water quality, water safety, and legislation, environmental legislation here on No Limits. My guests are Indra Frank, who is the environmental health director for the Hoosier Environmental Council, and Andrew Berger, who is vice president of governmental affairs and tax policy for the Indiana Manufacturers Association. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us a you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what a listener named Richard has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Richard, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Well, I'll give you a good example of the problem with this legislation. I was on the Indiana Air Board when it was first formed and when the boards actually had some authority. We received complaints from people in northern Indiana about the emissions from the coke plants. One of these emissions is benzene, a known carcinogen. The board took this under consideration, and we passed regulations that were above what the federal regulations were at the time. They were put into effect, and they resulted in reduction of benzene emissions from those coke plants. Now, the way this legislation has been written, that would be impossible to do. The people of Indiana deserve the right to protect their own health, and this basically takes it away from them. And the legislature has never been terribly effective in dealing with these kinds of problems. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call, Andrew.
Well, clearly I disagree with the fact that they could never do it. If the legislature said we need to have higher limits on benzene, they could certainly do that if they wanted to. If this person feels that the legislature hasn't been effective in doing that, they can certainly try and convince them otherwise. I don't feel that the legislature is particularly averse to environmental concerns, and if the case can be made, that's where it should be done. Not making a call to regulators. That's what we're actually trying to avoid here.
Also gotten an email from a listener named Gene. If you want to reach out to us via email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. It says, this bill sounds completely unnecessary. I'm interested in knowing from the bill's author, that would be Representative Walkins, was the American Legislative Exchange Council involved in the drafting of this legislation? Do you know the answer to that, Andrew?
I think the answer is no. I'm unaware of any connection to them.
Andrew, do you have any information on that?
It's my understanding that Representative Wilkins is involved with ALEC.
Okay, so that there is a possibility.
Well, he has authored a bill like this or exactly like this or some version of this for a number of years. So I think and by the way, mm-hmm. about 16 other states have a version of this. So it's not something new to Indiana or to the rest of the country.
So let me ask this, because what I hear from you is that there is broad agreement on the idea that the legislature should set the broad policy parameters. Are there changes in this bill, Indra, that would make it more acceptable to the Hoosier Environmental Council? And if so, what would they be?
Well, I'm afraid I can't think of any, John, because the core of this bill is the statement that a rule or standard adopted by the Environmental Rules Board may not be more stringent than the corresponding regulation established under federal law. And that statement is, like I said, the core of the bill, and it's a very broad, sweeping statement about all environmental regulation coming through the Rules Board.
Okay, so So basically, unless you change the fundamental nature of the bill, there's not likely to be any area of compromise or agreement.
Right. Yeah, that's true. And if I could just tag on to something Andrew said, he pointed out that some version of this no more stringent legislation has come up. My understanding is each year for the last dozen years or more. And I think that's an example of how long it can take an idea to get through the legislative process.
We are talking about water quality and water safety here on No Limits. Alfred, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hello, Alfred.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question. I'm curious about the use of phosphates and lead mitigation. In the city of Toledo, Ohio, last summer, there was a water crisis in which people couldn't drink out of the public water system because of toxic algae bloom caused by hypertrophic action from phosphates. I'm sure there's a simple explanation for how one evil can cure another, and I'd like to hear it. Thanks.
Okay, thanks very much for the call. Andrew, I'll throw that one to you.
I will give you what I know about this. It's true that when phosphates are put into our streams and rivers, that can cause an overgrowth of algae. In this case, we're talking about water that's been drawn up by a drinking water treatment plant, either from an underground well or from a river. And once that treatment plant takes the water, they're going to send it out through the pipes. In the process of sending it out through the pipes, they can add phosphate, which helps coat the pipes and reduce the amount of lead that leaches into the water that's contained in those pipes. Now, unfortunately, this probably does also increase the amount of phosphate that we're sending down our sinks and toilets and back out into the water system.
And I want to pick up on something. Andrew, you said that the 16 other states have a law like the one
at least
16. Yeah. Do we have information? Is there data on what the water quality and the environmental standards are like in those states? Do we have
it varies. I mean, you see a state like Virginia or Arizona or Kentucky or Mississippi. I mean, and so the regions are very different. The characteristics of those states are very different. I don't know if you can tie any specific environmental part of Indiana to the passage or non-passage of this bill, because ultimately it deals more with the policy process than any specific regulation.
But speaking to that policy process, in at least 9 of those states, there have been lawsuits because of the no more stringent than regulation. Unfortunately, the phrase more stringent doesn't have a solid legal definition. And what has happened in the lawsuits in these other states is that a regulated entity will contest the regulation that it's under and claim that, well, now that we have a no more stringent than law, our regulation, we think it's more stringent. That'll get battled out, and then the policy gets set by the courts instead of by either the legislature or the agency.
And I realize I have been remiss here. I probably should have asked this question when we first started talking about the bill. But it's one I sort of ask every time we talk about a piece of legislation or a proposed measure. What problem is this trying to solve? I mean, what is the need that it is supposed to address?
The need, from our members' perspective, is a very serious desire to avoid a lot of environmental chaos between the states. They're very favorable to consistency on regulation from one jurisdiction to another. And a lot of manufacturers do operate in multiple states. So having the same rules is what they really are after when it comes to state-by-state environmental policy. Frankly, we've also had situations in the past where the environmental policy is trying to be driven through the regulatory system. That is what's happening at the federal level right now. So beyond trying to get as consistent as possible, we're also trying to avoid problems in the future when there may be a more aggressive regulatory regime in place.
So if as I understand it, does federal law, when it comes to environmental standards, trump state law?
Yes.
It is the stricter. So the only option that states have would be they can't relax the environmental standards. Their only option they have is to go stricter, and you're trying to make it that a legislative responsibility rather than the regulatory one.
Correct.
Yes. But many of the federal environmental laws were designed with a good deal of delegation to the states. In fact, those environmental laws kind of set broad goals. For example, under the Clean Air Act, here in the United States, our air shall have no more than this much ozone. And then it's up to each of the states to look at the various sources of air emissions and how best to approach those. So the state designs its own solution. So what I'm saying is that the federal environmental laws have intentional open areas that are intended for the states to interpret. And well, we believe that this bill would interfere with our state's ability to implement those.
I don't see that as being the case.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want to get to another caller. If you would like to join the conversation by calling us, you can do so. Find us at 866-476-3881. Mary, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, sir, and certainly. Good afternoon. A question perhaps for Mr. Berger. I find your lack of realization that you may well be a foot soldier of ALEC in this endeavor, and I wanted to ask how corporations, you know, that operate across state lines. You're talking about very large ones. You know, recently United Technologies felt the need to let Carrier here in Indianapolis and Fort Wayne go to Mexico. I don't know if that's burdensome regulations that did this. Perhaps there's many other factors, but I would just ask, how is it that people might not have protection against sources of drinking water already, which may be lead from coal combustion waste ponds? We have many more in Indiana than, in fact, more than any other state, as I understand it, with very little testing or regulation that IDEM has even been able to do in the past. How should we have the right to ask for clean water and clean air? These are our rights as well. How do you think this bill will balance this out?
Okay, Mary, let me give Andrew a chance to respond. Thank you very much for the call and the question.
Thank you, and it's very simply done. I'll just use your example of the coal ash ponds. And this may come directly from the department, the experts who may feel a need to have a specific state statutory framework to regulate these. They get a bill drafted, ask somebody to author it, and moves through the legislative process, and now we have new protections to prevent the types of things you're worried about from a coal ash pond. That is the process that we see should be done on these issues.
And we're getting tight on time. I'm going to ask our callers and even our guests here to try to be concise in their responses. Ron, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thanks for taking my call. I have some things to throw out. First, I don't understand why 18th-century technology, as far as Flint and other places, that community wells couldn't be drilled in an emergency situation, water tested, and instead of hauling in bottled water, people could go to those community wells and help themselves to water. That's number one. Two, a product that when I was trying to build my house, I looked into. They weren't interested in dealing with a small individual. It's called Green Pipe. I have no connection with this company except that I wanted to use it. Their material has been tested for extreme cold, extreme hot. It could be used for drain. It's installed much like specs where special tools are required. And there's no leaching whatsoever into the water of anything. It was the safest thing going of anything known to man at this point. And I think anybody who's looking to replace their pipe should be looking into the Green Pipe. It's just my personal opinion. Number three, you step on a couple of toes here. All the talk of rules and regulations and what's allowed, and we've got American citizens, taxpayers, in imminent danger here, and we're talking about rules and regulations. It confirms my suspicion that what we really need in this country is a good king. So, bam, get it done. All right, thanks for taking my call.
Thank you very much, Ron. Okay, Andrew, I'm going to let you speak to the possibility of using wells as a response to these. Is that feasible in some fashion?
You know, I'm not entirely sure. It takes a while to install a new well, and I don't have a good answer for that question.
And I should say also that we had a tweet from a listener who asked basically the same question. It says, why is lead in drinking water not an emergency that requires an immediate fix period? Is it the money again, which is a variation of Ron's question, to why aren't we just simply treating this as an emergency that steps outside? And the question, at least in terms of this legislation, are we in agreement that the legislation would not affect state government's ability to declare an emergency and say we have to deal with this?
That's
true.
Yeah. That's true.
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to try to squeeze in another call here. George, you're on the line, on the air.
Yes, my question was, with the one school system being identified as having lead in their water system, did that trigger the Department of Environmental Quality to ask all school systems that were built during that time period at that school to be tested for lead content just to see how widespread the problem was? Or was it, the way I understood it, was just that one school did it on its own initiative, but wouldn't that indicate maybe all the schools should be tested just to see where we're at?
Well, that water system is getting tested. Yeah, and they've been testing since before June that I know of. That's when the state got involved.
George, I'm going to try to get an answer. I think, though, to be fair, thank you very much for the call and the question, George. I think where George was going with that is there are a lot of schools that are older in this state. Is there any kind of systemic, non-voluntary testing in place for those school systems, particularly the ones that operate in older buildings? Indra?
No. Under the current drinking water regulations, each system has to test, but there's nothing specific to schools.
Okay. Since we have spent a lot of time talking about House Bill 1082, we probably ought to give our listeners a report on where the bill is right now. Obviously, we're at that stage where bills have moved out of their house of origin, and it's over in the Senate now, is it?
Yes. So Indra and I did this in committee yesterday.
Okay. And you're spending a lot of quality time together. Right?
Yes. Okay. And the bill was not voted on in committee, and it's pending before the Senate Environmental Affairs, and okay. We'll see where it goes.
And obviously, if it doesn't make it out of committee, that's it, right? You start again next year? Presumably.
Maybe.
And if you do, well, yeah, nothing is ever really dead at the Indiana State House. Well, I would like to thank both of you for what has been an illuminating conversation here. I've learned a lot more about water and lead than I ever would have thought possible. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, John.
Very good to be here.
I've really enjoyed talking with you. Also, would like to thank our listeners. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of your questions. This is not the last time we're going to talk about this. Hope you'll tune in on Thursday when we're going to be talking about challenges facing higher education with Mitch Daniels, Teresa Lubbers, and Thomas Miner. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations. We'll be right back.